Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner. Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
From Autosport.com and Autosport Magazine, I'm Martin Lee, and this is the Autosport Podcast. And welcome back to Series 3 of our world-famous Top 10s. Might not be world-famous, but I'll throw it in for those willing to believe it. And of course, all put together by our chief editor and our first guest on the podcast today, Kevin Turner. Kev, you are back. You can't get enough of making lists, and thank you for that.
Oh, I'm fired up and looking forward to this. Yeah, I think Series 2 was a bit niche, wasn't it? We had to kind of complete the teams. We did the big teams in Series 1, and then we did some famous but kind of maybe a bit retro team series two. I think the series three will be a bit more broader appeal.
Well, let's see what we come up with this series. Thank you very much, dear listener, for tuning into this. We'll take you through a little preview of the series in a moment after I introduce our second guest on the podcast today. That is motorsport journalist and former Autosport ringleader, Damien Smith.
Hello. Nice to be back.
Good to have you back on the podcast.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And I'm looking forward to a new season of motorsport in 2023. There's some nice stories out there, actually. It's from F1 to various different series.
Yeah, well, there's an awful lot going on, obviously, in F1, as always. But yeah, we were just saying WRC is looking good now. We got Ott Tanak having got an M Sport drive to take on the incredible Kalle Rovanperä, who for me was the driver of 2022. So that's looking good. Yeah, there's lots to look forward to, isn't there?
Do you think in rally, if Rovanperä can prove himself against an on-form Tanak, you know, who's got a full-time drive, forget the Sebastians because they're not going to be full-time competition, that elevates Rovanperä when he's proved himself against a great driver if the car is great as well?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, all the big drivers, they all want to be against someone who can give them a run for the money because I think they enjoy it more. They all relish that battle more. I think in every form of motorsport, that's the case. And I think he'll welcome the fact that he's got someone in another car as well. And, you know, from the evidence of last year, Tanak was the closest one to giving him a run for his money and, you know, beat him on occasion. So it's looking good.
Yeah, you can gauge how good your win is by who finishes second sometimes, can't you? So if you've got, I was doing a Mansell list, which we haven't done a podcast on, but we could do. Doing a Mansell list, and one of the candidates for that was Portugal 86, where behind him was Prost, Senna, Piquet. You think, well, if they were setting third and fourth, that's probably quite a good day.
Yeah. Let's get into our new series of top tens. Give us a preview of some of the shows coming up later in the series, not today's.
Okay, so we're going to do the greatest F1 drivers not to win the World Championship. So that'll be that's quite a nice pub debate type one.
It's a meaty one,
which we haven't looked at for quite a long time, actually.
I wonder who's going to be number one for that.
Yeah, yeah, some of these lists maybe don't have the hardest of number ones. But yeah, and then we do one-hit wonders.
Yep.
We'll do wet weather races. And we're also going to do a couple of car ones. So we're going to do a best cars that didn't win a Grand Prix. And also the worst cars that did. We haven't done many worst.
Oh, I like that.
And I think worst cars is all right. I think if you do worst drivers, it's a bit personal. But I think worst car. Bearing in mind that one of the leading contenders for that list, the designer, says, yeah, it was terrible. I think we're okay to do a top 10 worst F1 cars to win a Grand Prix.
I thought you were going to say that the designer was adamant it was the best thing that he ever did.
I think they can say that right up to when the car hits the track.
Right.
And go, oh, because the stopwatch doesn't lie, does it?
Let's get into our first show of this brand new series. Kev, what have you lined up for our first show?
So it's the top 10 F1 drivers not to win a World Championship Grand Prix.
F1 drivers, a Grand Prix, World Championship Grand Prix.
Yeah, so people that aren't one of the 103 winners of a World Championship race, which that does include the Indy 500s, which is a boring anomaly we have to keep mentioning every time, 1950 to 60. They might have won an F1 race, which we'll come to later, but not a World Championship Grand Prix. And they have to have been in F1. So we're not talking about people like Tom Christensen, and obviously clearly Mega, or a whole range of American drivers that have had fantastic careers but never started a race. That's a different list.
Yep.
So this one is people that did start F1 races but didn't win a Grand Prix.
Let's get into it. And for newbies to our list making, we start with, obviously, number 10. But that does also include a bit of a chat sometimes about the drivers that missed out. You know, places that if we put them in 11, 12, 13, the ones that missed out. So let's kick us off then, Kev. Where do we start?
So number 10 is Stefan Johansson, who started 79 races, did finish second, got 12 podiums, didn't get any poles or fastest laps. So he's in there, I think, because of I'd be interested to see what Damien thinks about Johansson. He was a very good driver. I don't think he was top draw. So as we get further into this, it'll become more and more offensive that the driver in question didn't get a win. I can't think of a race that particularly stands out for Johansson and go, yes, he should definitely have won that. But I think for his long journey, drove for Ferrari and McLaren, was, a strong drive, did a good job. Just for the kind of the record and longevity within F1 in the sort of mid 80s, I thought he deserved a mention, really.
Yeah, I think that you're right. He's very popular, wasn't he? And he was a popular figure in the paddock, both socially but also professionally, that he was rated as someone who you could plug in to do a good job when you needed them. And I guess he kind of did that at McLaren. He was kind of, replacing Keke Rosberg, and he served his purpose for that one season before Senna joined. But he was never, he was never any threat to Prost. He was clearly a number two. And if the cards had fallen right for him, he might have lucked into a win. But as you say, I can't think of a race where you think, one that got away, he really should have won that one.
Yeah, I kind of think of him almost like a little bit of a Sergio Perez in that way, in that kind of doing a very obvious backup role. But probably wasn't even as close to Prost overall on performance as Perez occasionally has been to Verstappen.
Yeah, and he was he's an interesting man and had an interesting career after Formula One. Had those years in IndyCar where again he didn't really never quite shone, did he? But he was in a very competitive era, and he was never in a top drive. But he did well with what he had, and then he won Le Mans with Christensen and Alboreto. So it really, I think that was a lovely point almost to think of, not the end of his career because he went on beyond that, but that was the latter stages of his career. It was a win that he deserved, I think, to have something of that nature, that stature.
To hang his hat on, really.
Yeah. And I think he deserved it.
This is the random thing I came across the other day. So Johansson plays a part in two of the greatest Nigel Mansell overtakes, which are among the best ever, because I think if we're doing a list of greatest overtakers, Mansell's got to be in contention in there. Obviously, famously, the Hungarian Grand Prix in 1989, he was in the very slow, but even slower than normal because he had gearbox problems, Onyx, when Senna and Mansell appeared, and there's that famous three abreast moment where Mansell goes. But also, I've been doing a bit of research on this, he's the backmarker that is kind of partly in the way. He's not really done anything wrong, he just happens to be there, when Mansell goes around the outside of Paul Tracy to win the New Hampshire race in 1993 kart race, which is he's probably his best IndyCar win. So just a completely random thing where Mansell's and Johansson's careers just momentarily crossed, allowing Nige to pull off a couple of great passes. I'm just a random thought there.
I like it. A little mention, if you want or not, for any drivers who you maybe made your long list, but get an honourable mention, but not the top 10.
Well, I will say that obviously we're excluding current drivers. So obviously someone like Lando Norris, yeah, we hope will score a Grand Prix win. We're not talking about people like Nico Hülkenberg because he's coming back to F1. But I guess Tom Price would be
Tom one. Price, yeah. Because I saw Tony Bries is on the list. We'll get to him in a minute. And I always think of Tom Price and Bries in a sort of, because they're similar era and they both had terrible, tragic deaths. But they're also both mega. And I think Price should have been on this list.
So
I would probably put him in actually 10th. I'd probably knock Stefan out.
Yeah, I think the Lost Generation, David Tremaine's yes. book, I think is an excellent book, and I recommend anyone to go and read that. Obviously, Roger Williamson being the third of those three lost talents, British talents of the 70s. The reason I put Bries in there and not Price, Price did win a Formula One race, of course, did win the Race of Champions at Brands Hatch for Shadow. But the reason he's not there is I don't think he really tucks Jean-Pierre Jarier up, particularly when they're teammates. You say perhaps Jarier maybe had the edge overall. Okay, maybe that would have changed as time went by and Price had more of a career. Whereas I think Bries compares very favourably to Alan Jones, who obviously went on... Well, Jarier went on to not win a Grand Prix. Tune in for episode 2 of the Series 3 podcast. Whereas Jones did go on to... a winner world champion. Actually, I think it's probably a bit underrated in history. I think he retired too soon. So that was my argument for Bries getting into this. So he's eighth. He did only start 10 Grand Prix. His best finish was sixth, so statistically quite weak. But when I read David's book, it was really Bries that stood out to me as being like, this guy was something really special. I think Price was good. I think Williamson, it was probably a bit too early to say. But Bries, he's the one that jumped out to me as, this guy was mega.
Yeah. Everyone says that, don't they? Who worked with him or had any involvement with him.
That's the feeling you get, isn't it? Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Well, we'll get on.
Well, we've done number 8 now.
Sorry, that was my fault.
Completely screwed the top 10 fault. List.
And then between those two drivers, yes. Let's come slightly more up to date. Who's in number 9th place?
So 9 is Romain Grosjean, 179 starts, so a lot more than most on this list. Best finish of second, 10 podiums, 1 fastest lap. Really wasn't sure what to do with Grosjean. I find he's one of those drivers I find really irritating.
In what way?
Because in terms of basic ability, he was really quick. Like at Lotus, he was quicker than Kimi Raikkonen. Once he stopped crashing, he was quicker, and he was for a while. It's easy to forget, but when Vettel was going on his winning spree in 2012, especially 2013. It was really actually that Grosjean came closest to stopping him. There's one race at the Nürburgring where he was very close. He had some really good drives where he was really only beaten by a better car. And I would suggest there are probably less talented drivers who have won a Grand Prix. But Grosjean's also frustrated. Quite often, he's kind of enigmatic, and we've talked about this before. I'm not a fan of that sort of driver. Like, you need to deliver the goods every time. And Grosjean's a bit up and down. Even at Haas, you'd see him get the big result, but Magnussen be the more consistent runner. Going across to IndyCar, he's been the same. You think an F1 driver of his ability should go in there and be doing more. But he's peripheral. He's like the anti-Alonso. Alonso knows where everyone is all the time. And you get the impression that Grosjean barely knows what's next to his car. I think that's the... So he's there. I think he needs to be there on pure ability, but I don't think he could get much higher because I think he... quite often was the architect of his own downfall.
Yeah, I'd agree. I was actually talking to him just the other day about his Lamborghini, new Lamborghini deal. And he's a great guy to talk to. He's very interesting, very articulate and really bright. With his experience, you just think you should be doing more. And I think he knows it for the IndyCar season just gone. He was very open that it was a disappointing year. And he struggled with the Andretti setup and getting comfortable with the setup they used, and he had to sort of work with his engineer to try and find some common ground, I think. And he said it got better towards the end of the year, and he's quite confident for next year, but he knows he should be winning races in IndyCar. I think that's the thing. So I think that's this coming season's a big one for him. And the bubble kind of burst for him because he came in to Coyne having come off the back of that horrendous crash, a lot of goodwill, and of course he did really well in that first year, And then last year he had lots of collisions and troubles with other drivers that we'd sort of seen that side of him in Formula One, and he's kind of a bit labelled by that sort of troublemaker thing, isn't he? That he's not great wheel to wheel.
Yeah, I mean, he's an interesting choice for an endurance driver, isn't he?
Yeah,
I mean, of course, he was very quick in the Matic Ford GT.
Yes.
I spoke to him when he was doing his FIA GT, and I kind of wasn't sure what to expect. ex-F1 driver that's kind of down and trying to get back in. Mm. And as you say, he was a lovely guy to speak to. And he did a really good job. But you think you've got to really have your wits about you in those cars when you're lapping traffic and potentially fighting cars of a similar performance.
Mm.
So, yeah, but it'd be interesting how he gets on.
He says something that will appeal to you, Kev, though, because he quoted Mario Andretti and doing the Indy 500 and flying back to Europe, you know, and sort of doing F1 and IndyCar at the same time. He wants to do IndyCar and sports car at the same time. And because they keep the big Enduros in America away from the IndyCar schedule, he says, I can do both. And he's really excited by that prospect.
Yeah, that's cool.
And it's great to hear a driver having that enthusiasm to do two codes at once, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, we've half touched on our next number 8 place, but Kev, give us the stats on this driver and we'll have a bit more of a chat as well.
So 8 is Tony Bryce, 1975, 10 starts, best finish 6th, no podiums, no poles, no fastest laps, which obviously sounds, yeah, that does not sound outstanding, but as we were just saying, I think he was an outstanding talent. Yeah, the car he had, you know, that was the Embassy Hill operation, as Graham Hill obviously was stepping down from, I think he saw something in Bryce is the kind of impression you get. You know, compared favourably to, admittedly, still also quite a young Alan Jones at that time. I think this is perhaps going slightly against my usual thing of I tend to plump for actual races and careers and statistics that are there as opposed to what might have been. Mm. But I think in this case, there's just a feeling that he was the one of those three that could have gone on to achieve something.
I like your thinking. I think I would probably put him a bit lower down. For that reason, that we haven't got enough evidence, because no matter how good your junior career is, it only really counts when you start doing it in Formula One, doesn't it? We've seen it countless times with so many drivers, you know, from Jan Magnussen to, you know, there's just so many of them.
Or the next person on the list, even.
Oh, exactly. You know, as I said earlier, everyone who sort of worked with Bryce in Formula 3, and they all say he was special, and the indications were he would have been, but 8th on this list, I would probably put him a bit lower.
Let's move on. A driver that did come into Formula 1 having won German F3 and Formula 3000, highly rated, with big backing as well, but ultimately, you say, failed to deliver. Tell us about him.
So this is almost the opposite, and there's lots and lots of data about this driver. So number 7 is Nick Heidfeld, 2000 to 2011, 183 starts, best finish to 2nd, 13 podiums, which I believe is a record for a non-Grand Prix winner. One pole, two fastest laps. So there will be a lot of people that say that Nick should be higher up this list. But I just think he was another one, maybe a slightly better version of Johansson, in the sense that he was a very good driver, hung around a long time, did a good job, but never quite. He wasn't a megastar in an era where you've got, you know, Sebastian Vettel, Lewis Hamilton, Fernando Alonso, Robert Kubica, his teammate for a while. Yeah. He's just not quite in that. I think perhaps he's a little unfortunate. He's perhaps a little bit more unfortunate than Johansson, because he should probably have got he could have made a strong case for getting the McLaren gig after performing strongly against Kimi Raikkonen at Sauber in Kimi's first season. But everyone got starstruck by the young Finn, didn't they? And off he went to have a career at McLaren and, you know, won quite a few races in the World Championship with Ferrari. So, in a parallel universe, Nick Heidfeld probably is a Grand Prix winner, but I don't know. Again, there's not really one that particularly stands out to me, except you could say he did play the team game at 2008 Canadian Grand Prix. You know, he was on a one stopper, and Robert Kubica, his teammate, was on a two stopper, and Lewis Hamilton managed to take himself and Kimi Raikkonen out of that race with the pit lane snafu, and Heidfeld played the team game, let Kubica through on his, you know, his different strategy, and then held up, I think, Fernando Alonso's Renault to help him out, and Kubica was able to build a big enough lead to come in and out and take the win. But if Kubica was on this list, he'd be higher, because I think he was mega.
Yeah.
So I'm pleased that he was a Grand Prix winner. So, yeah, Nick, 7th for me, I think.
Yeah, the late, great Simon Aron used to call Nick Heidfeld Nick Interesting, because he wasn't very interesting, but he was... I just always think of Heidfeld as, like, perfect professional, just really, really solid, who you could plug into a team and would do exactly what you expect him to do, whether it was at BMW or Williams. He was just a solid performer, and I kind of wish one a drop for him, so he wouldn't be on this list. I think he deserved one win.
I'd agree with that. And in a previous, if you think that was a really competitive era as well that he was operating in, both in terms of drivers, but also manufacturer involvement in F1, and he very much held his own within that environment for, you know, a decade.
And he had the machinery at the time to do it.
And of course, he also was he was the other guy that did a good job at Silverstone in 2008. It's just that he was a minute behind Lewis Hamilton's, you know, I think probably still, after all this time, one of Lewis Hamilton's standout drives. Just a previous era, let's face it, in a previous era when cars were less reliable, he'd have almost certainly chalked one or two up.
Yeah, he hung around a long time. And, he had a very good career beyond Formula One as well, in the sense that he managed to successfully become a decent Formula E driver, and then he's had a sports car career as well, and he's just good. He's just a really good solid pro, and he wasn't quite the mega driver we thought he might have been in 99 when he won that 3000 title, because he did look awesome in that year, and the momentum didn't quite carry on despite the fact he had the McLaren link. So you think the fact it didn't suggests he wasn't quite there, and I think the evidence, there's a lot of evidence, isn't there, let's face it. The evidence is he was a really good Formula One driver, but nothing more, nothing to be ashamed of by that, by the way, and big respect to him.
Well, from Nick, interesting, in seventh place, who's in sixth?
Can we do the next two together?
Yeah, if you want.
To do that. So I think these two always, they came up together in the Tyrrell list that we did, and they're together in this as well, but in kind of slightly different ways. So at six, I've got Stefan Beloff, and at fifth, I've got Martin Brundle. Okay. So they were Tyrrell teammates, came into F1 in 1984. Now, after a year and a half, you'd say probably Beloff was the... I mean, I think that it's one of these things that you get killed early on, it kind of helps the legend and mystique. And that's what I mean about that versus actual results and knowledge and data that we have. So this is that kind of problem. So I'd say that Beloff probably did have a marginal advantage over Brundle in their year and a half together. It's actually quite close when you look at the qualifying and the racing. It's marginal, but you'd say probably Beloff is slightly ahead. But then, of course, he was killed at Spa in a sports car race trying to go around the outside of Jackie Ickx at Eau Rouge in a 956 Porsche, which I think was his fault. I mean, it was a misjudgment, but she paid a high price for. And I put him behind Brundle because of Brundle's longevity. We saw so much of him in F1. He deserved to. And he was in hopeless cars as well. So I actually, of course, on the stats, Stefan's best finish is fourth, but actually it was second because he was third, Monaco.
Monaco third, yeah.
But of course, that was expunged from the record books when they needed a rule change, so they kicked Tyrrell out of there. There's a podcast in that somewhere as well. So the 1984 results for Martin and for Stefan don't exist. So Martin Brundle officially has 9 podiums, although he also got a second place finish that season. No poles and no fastest laps, but he probably came a bit closer as well. Canada 92, he could maybe have won.
Yeah.
So he compared pretty well actually to Marcus Schumacher in 92. So I just felt that his longevity and comparing more consistently across a long period of time just edged him ahead of Beloff, even if Beloff was perhaps a bit faster.
Are they in the right order?
Yeah, I think so. I would agree with the order. Just a couple of thoughts on these two. I remember running a piece on Beloff in another magazine, and Martin basically said he was the fastest driver he came up against, and in terms of pure ability. But he did always... It's easy with hindsight, but he had that demeanour of a driver who wasn't going to grow old, wasn't he? He was just so wild.
And you would have thought that sports car racing, especially partnered with someone like Derek Bell, who'd been around a bit, would have kind of... Derek's quite... he's been quite outspoken about this because he got a bit fed up having to bring the fuel mileage back on. Stefan would go out and use all the fuel, and Derek would have to tool round for his stint, look really slow, but to get the fuel. And of course, the Nürburgring, the famous, fastest lap ever. But then they didn't win the race because he put it on his roof and rolled it into a ball. And you kind of think that in a period where cars were more dangerous, both in sports car racing and Formula One, that maybe he was just too on the limit and that he was chancing his arm too often. and that he was always going to get caught out eventually. But yeah, maybe that's a bit unfair because, you know, Martin obviously had a big crash in 84 as well. So, you know, it's a little bit of luck there. But
yeah, and Martin, he drove some dogs, didn't he? He really did. Yes, I mean, when he got in a decent car like the 89 Brabham, he showed really well in that car with no finance, a team that was really, you know, on the downward spiral. And then the 92 Benetton, you know, I've done quite a lot on this because I'm writing a book on Benetton at the moment. Just a little plug there. So Pat Simmons says that of all the drivers he's worked with, Martin was the one that he underrated the most, and he didn't realise until years later just how good Martin was in 92 against Schumacher, and that, you know, he deserves a lot more credit than he got. He had a really difficult start to that year, and things just weren't going his way while Schumacher was coming off the back of 91 and those first few races with Benetton, that incredible Jordan debut, and he just kept it going, and he was scoring consistently and scoring podiums, and Martin was in relation was struggling. Then Canada happened, which he should have won, and he would have won without a mechanical problem, and Martin still thinks that's the one that got away. He tells a nice story that he got out of the car and Senna had retired at the same point of the circuit. And Senna looked at him and said, "Hurts, doesn't it?" And Martin said, "Yeah, it really does." And then Senna went back, and Martin was left with the McLaren. So he got in the car and had a look round, had an opportunity to have a good look around it. So, it's interesting talking to people who worked at Benetton. They really rated him, particularly in hindsight. And even Briatore now admits that it was a mistake to let him go at the end of the year. And obviously, Patrese didn't work out very well for them in 93. You know, Martin deserved to keep that drive for a second year.
Yeah, I completely, you know, agree with all that. And I was going to say, once he got over that kind of I can't match Schumacher over a single lap thing, his race pace was often as good. Like, they would often be together. Sometimes Martin would be ahead. He was ahead of Schumacher at the British Grand Prix when the Williamses were going down the road. And actually, I think Martin was ahead of Schumacher at Spa. And it Shuey went off.
Martin went past him. And it was as Martin went past him that Shuey recognised the state of Martin's tyres and made a call there and then to come straight into the pits to change. And that won in the race. And Martin says, you know, if I'd just made the same call, but Martin couldn't see his own tyres. So, you know, but if he'd made that call to come in on that lap, he probably would have won the Belgian Grand Prix, and Schumacher would have been second to him.
Yeah, I mean, that says a lot about Mark Schumacher as well. But
It says an awful lot about Mark Schumacher.
Yeah, but yeah. The fact is that Martin was in the same vicinity, and one of them is a 91-time Grand Prix winner with 7 world titles, and Martin didn't get one, which...
They had a lot of respect for each other, actually. Michael respected Martin, and they got on really well that year. And I think Martin said there was an occasion years later where... During his punditry time, he said something that was translated into German, and Michael took offence at it, and they didn't speak for years because of that, which was a shame. But happily, they did get over that eventually, and became quite friendly again. But I think Michael, from everything I've heard and read and people I've spoken to, he had respect for Martin, and I think that says a lot, given that Michael didn't have a lot of respect for anyone at that time.
Okay, we're four to go. We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll get into debate the next four drivers.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Progressive presents Adjusting to the Suburbs.
I never really thought about tools until I bought a house in the suburbs. It's like this weird homeowner test if I need a tool for a project and don't have it. And my neighbor Ted loves to give me that look when I ask to borrow a pole saw. A year ago, I didn't even know pole saws existed. And now I gotta borrow one from Ted? What is happening?
Anyway, when you save with Progressive by bundling your home and auto, that's the easy part of adjusting to the suburbs. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company coverage provided in service by affiliates and third-party insurers.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
Welcome back to our Autosport Top 10s, and we're talking about the greatest Formula One drivers never to have won a World Championship Formula One race, and there are four to go. Let's get into it then. Kevin Turner, who's in fourth place?
Fourth is Derek Warwick, who was only about seventh on this list when we did it 2014. When I say we, I was only peripherally involved, which is why I've been able to correct it in this. I'm going to admit, I know Derek well, and I've worked with him as part of the Aston Martin Autosport BIDC Driver Award, and he's just a phenomenon, really. He's a driving force. You can see why he won a World Sports Car Championship and won Le Mans, and why everything he touches, he's just driven. He's just one of those successful people, and it only makes it more baffling to me that he didn't win a World Challenger Grand Prix. You have to remember, in that sort of pre-Mansell going to Williams in 85, Derek was probably the British talent that everyone was expecting to be the next challenger. So he got the Renault deal in 84, and he led the way again for that team most of the time. Would have won the Brazilian Grand Prix, but his suspension broke after an earlier clash with Niki Lauda's McLaren. But after that, he never really had as good a kit again. He stayed around at Renault in 85 when the car was absolutely awful. I think they went to him and Patrick Tambay went to the first test, and it was 2 or 3 seconds of that slow in the previous car, and they went, oh. And he hadn't, didn't go to Williams, and he got a chance to go to Lotus, and Ayrton Senna, vetoed that famously, and then sent him a Christmas card. and because Senna didn't think, quite rightly probably at the time, that Lotus couldn't run two equal cars, and he wanted it all to be focused on him. So, I just think a very high-performing driver that's around a long time. So his stats, 146 starts, best finish of second, 4 podiums, 2 fast laps, no poles. And he did a great job, I think, at footwork or arrows, as it was called. He saw off Eddie Cheever, had a great day in Canada. But actually, that's the most famous one. Yeah, he could have won that race, with the caveat that obviously Senna should have won it, but had his own car failure. But he had lots and lots of other performances, which these days would be regarded as excellent midfield, getting into the top 10 point scoring opportunities. But he had an awful lot of seventh places. So I think Lando Norris at that point, but now seventh place looks mega behind the big three and you get points. Whereas then it's like, oh, we don't care if he finishes seventh. So, for me, Derek's just one of those drivers that I should have won a Grand Prix.
Yeah, and as you say, Kev, that mid-80s era, in terms of the next Brit who was going to start winning Grand Prix, everyone thought it was Derek, didn't they, rather than Mansell. And I think the big sliding doors moment was that 85 season when apparently he had the Williams drive offered to him, and how times change. The story goes that he was asking the likes of Autosport's Nigel Roebuck and Alan Henry, what should I do? They kind of said, stay where you are, because Renault, is a good place to be. And of course, whoever takes the blame for that decision, it's Derek essentially who turned down the Williams drive, apparently, and therefore Mansell took that drive, ended up winning Grand Prix and becoming the Nigel Mansell we all know, and Derek never got the chance of a top drive again. It's pretty brutal in that sense. And he's had to live with Mansell having won 31 races and he hasn't won any.
I get the impression he's not too bitter about that. I mean, obviously they're mates, and I think Derek's one of the few people that can take the mickey out of Nigel and sort of get away with it, really, because I think there's a sort of mutual respect there as well. I think the one it probably rankles with him more is the Senna thing, because he'd have liked to have compared himself to the best or certainly the fastest, arguably the best driver of his generation. You know, how good was it? Because, you know, Derek had seen off teammates before. He'd obviously been against Nelson Piquet in F3. Like, at that point, he didn't really fear anyone.
He's an interesting case because he, you know, going further back, 79, he moved up to Formula 2 and had a disaster of a season with a customer March, and it was horror season, almost finished his career. And he was amazed that Tolman came in for him in 80 to partner, turned out to be Brian Henton, and was going to be Stephen South, and then he got sacked and Henton came in. And he very much played the understudy to Henton that season, and you know, they dominated the European F2 Championship. He did win races, but Henton was the man. And that sort of carried on into Tolman when they went into Formula 1 with those dreadful early cars. And you couldn't really judge anyone on those cars. But by 83, he'd kind of grown into Formula 1, hadn't he? And he'd become a really solid performer, which is why he got the Renault deal.
Well, actually, he points out he was a consistent point scorer at the end of 83 with the Tolman, because, yeah, history records, Al Senna came in and was amazing in that car in 84. He's like, well, actually, the car was pretty good by the end of 83, as Derek showed with all those. And I do wonder whether Ayrton, being the savvy person that he was, he'd have known how good Derek was from what Tolman had told him. So I imagine then a couple of years later when he's at Lotus, he thinks, I don't really fancy being in a British team with a talented British driver. No language barrier, all this. Yep. I think maybe I'd rather not have that as an added problem in my season.
But it's interesting that that attitude, being concerned about driving for a British team and not being Brit. Senna had it. We've seen it with Alonso. Sebastian Loeb had it in rallying. He was always put off driving for British teams. I was talking to David Richards recently, and he was saying that Guy Frecklin at Citroën was always whispering in Loeb's ear, don't go to a British team because you'll get screwed over. You won't get a fair crack at it. And when he finally drove for ProDrive in Dakar, as he is now, you know, his first visit to ProDrive, David said, go and look around, anything you want, you know, ask any questions. And he was kind of amazed at how open things were, and it was almost like, oh, I wonder if I could have done this earlier, you know. So a lot of those drivers, and Alonso's always had that thing about, you know, sort of McLaren in 07, that he was, because he was a Spaniard coming into a team with a young rookie Brit, that there was a prejudice against him. It's that sort of paranoia.
Yeah, and then you've got someone like Alain Prost or Sebastian Vettel who've embraced the sort of British teams that they joined and the whole British culture. And we had Seb, obviously, at the Autosport Awards in December. And, you know, he said loved, you know, the British motorsport culture and all the rest of it. So, yeah, it's an interesting one, that.
Let's get onto the podium and the top three places. Who have you put in third place?
So third is Jean-Pierre Jarier, and he's here. I'm not suggesting that he's the third most talented driver on this list. He's here because I factored in how ridiculously close he got to winning a race. And actually did it, well, as I say, he did it three times. One of those doesn't even count because he didn't get to start the pole position that he had at Shadow in 75, the first race. But he should have won the Brazilian Grand Prix with the Shadows absolutely disappearing down the road and the car broke towards the end. And when, after Ronnie Peterson was killed at Monza in 1978, he jumped into the Lotus 79 and was winning the Canadian Grand Prix quite comfortably as well. More than the other drivers on this list so far, he had the job done twice. Not just early on, or possibly could have won, would have won, was going to win, and was stopped through no fault of his own. So, as I say, I think there are probably other drivers on this list who perhaps were overall better drivers, and who had better careers, but in terms of how close they got, you know, he that elevated him on this list for me.
That's an interesting choice and point, and I can see where you're driving with that, Kev, that he did get close. And I think people forget that he was actually pretty handy in that mid-70s era, because by the end of his F1 career, I think he was considered a bit of a journeyman and a bit of a mobile chicane at times, and you know, which is a bit harsh, really, because he was, you know, especially, as I say, when he first appeared on the scene and made his those Shadow days, he appeared to have everything going for him.
When you're putting the list together, how much weighting do you give driver mistakes versus machinery letting them down in terms of where you feel compelled to put them in the top 10?
Oh, I think that's quite key. I think if you're leading the race but you stick it in the wall, yeah, that's on you that you didn't win a race. But I think a lot, you know, most of the people on this list, that's not the case. I remember speaking to Tony Southgate about the Brazil 75 race. He said the most ridiculous minor, I can't remember exactly what it was now, but the minor thing that put the car out that they'd never had before, didn't have subsequently, and the guys fired it up and was fine afterwards.
It could be like a washer
just
that cost 50 pence.
That sort of nonsense, really. Yeah. The Shadow DN5 will appear on another Series 3 podcast. Damien's point, actually, that the back end of his career perhaps was less impressive. This is more about how good he was early on. You know, they were quick at Monaco as well. Had a good downforce, that car. And he generally sort of had a little edge over Tom Price. Not enormous. It's mainly the how close he got. And then, as you say, lost through no fault of his own. Didn't say the stats, did I? But he started 134 races. Best finisher third, podiums three, poles three, fastest laps three. So to get three poles, there aren't many F1 drivers that have taken three poles and not got a win.
Actually, I just thought of someone who should be on this list, in my opinion, Teo Fabi, who was also, he took how many poles? Two poles, was it?
And didn't need a lap.
Never led a lap at Grand Prix, no.
But is that not a, I suppose it depends why he didn't lead the lap.
Again, you speak to people who worked with him at the Benetton and time, and he was megaly fast, particularly through the fast corners, which is why he was good on ovals, wasn't he, in IndyCar? You know, really brave and really committed, and in terms of pure talent, was there. Didn't quite have it mentally, I think, but he would have been a good one to chuck in this list. And I think if you're looking at Tony Brys and Stefan Johansson, I would argue he could be knocking on their places.
Interesting. Let's go back.
I'm making a note.
Oh.
It's what's now known as the Karun Chandhok note, because he forced me to make a note during Series 1.
It's been 8 years since you had revised this year list. So at the turn of the decade's end, you can revisit that note. And besides,
Series 8 of the Top 10 podcast.
Did I get that wrong? Right, final two then. And let's go back to the early days of the World Championship. Who's in second place?
Yeah, I'm not going to do the top two together. I know tradition says that I should, but I'm not going to, because I think we want to speak about these two individually. If that's all right, you're the master.
No, go ahead.
Number two is Jean Behra, 1951 to 59, starts 52, best finish of second, 9 podiums and 1 fastest lap. And I think the top two on this list are pretty clear. I'm fairly comfortable with the order. I know that a former editor who I've been in contact with recently did admit that they put the order the other way around in 2014 just to be provocative, really.
Oh, really?
And to just be different, because they didn't want to be too predictable. Okay. But I'm happy to be predictable if that's correct.
It's the accuracy to get the list right.
Exactly. So Behra was actually a top driver. I'd say he was a top driver of the 50s, comfortably the best driver that didn't win a World Championship Grand Prix. And, of course, did win quite a few F1 races, but they were non-championship. He also led, he should have won the 1957 British Grand Prix at Aintree, had that in the famous race that obviously Moss comes through to win in the Van Moor that Tony Brooks started. You know, Behra was down the road in his 250F Maserati. So, he won numerous non-championship F1 races, works driver at Maserati, well-regarded at BRM when he was there, really lifted their spirits with a couple of non-championship wins in CAT and then the International Trophy. So he was an F1 winner. He just didn't get that World Championship win. I don't think he's quite on a par with the benchmark drivers of his era. If we're talking Moss and Fangio, his teammates to both of them during his career, and they did have the edge, as you would probably expect. But he wasn't a million miles away. You know, he was a definite top-draw driver of the era.
He's one of those on his day drivers, you know, when everything aligned, like that day at Aintree you mentioned, he was a match for the best of that time, but not consistently so. But I think he's definitely of that era. He's the standout, and I probably wouldn't argue with you, Kev, to have him that high up on the list.
Yeah, I mean, he won, I'm just having a quick look, he won F1 races in 54, 55, won quite a lot in 57, in two different cars, the 250F Maserati and the BRM. And obviously non-championship F1 races could range from basically a Grand Prix, like the International Trophy, but just not a championship counting around, to some minor events. So there is a mix of quality across the races that he won, but I don't think any of his... I'm pretty sure the contemporaries you know, would have seen him as a threat. And when we did the piece a few years back on him, we spoke to Ian Titchmarsh, who's another guest on our Top 10 podcast sometimes, and he did say that, you know, that at the time, yeah, he would have been regarded as one of the top three or four drivers, you know, in say the late 50s. And now, if you're one of the top three or four drivers, you're gonna win races, aren't you?
It's another one of those intriguing ones. If had he lived beyond 59, and what would he have been like in the 1.5 litre era in Formula One in the '60s? You know?
Yeah, he'd fallen out with Ferrari, the Ferrari team, and walked out. He was killed at Avis in his own Porsche, but he was still very popular at Bourne. So there's a good chance that he may have found himself in a BRM. In 60-61, if he then hung around, would he have had access to the 1.5 litre V8 in which Graham Hill won the World Championship in? And then he's probably on ability, he's probably somewhere between Hill and Richie Ginther. So Ginther didn't quite get a win with BRM. You kind of get into more and more conjecture, don't you? But we're definitely into the realm of it's offensive that this driver didn't win a World Championship race.
All right, is it offensive that the number one driver didn't win a World Championship race? Who is it, and what are their stats?
Number one is Chris Amon, 96.376, 96 starts, a best finish of second, 11 podiums, 5 poles, and 3 fastest laps, and I think this is a comfortable number one. Okay. There are some people that rate Amon as being among the best of his era, and would have fought for a world championship. Never mind a win. Yeah, he's probably the only driver on this list you'd say was perhaps good enough to win a world championship. That's a bit debated with some of the other people further down the list, perhaps. But the main reason he's on this list is this: the number of times he's in position to win a Grand Prix. So it's Spanish Grand Prix 1968. And by the way, he's leading Ferrari in 68 with Jackie Ickx as his teammate. So and he's the team leader. So that tells you something. Ickx is obviously a legend. So he's leading Spanish Grand Prix in 68 when his fuel pump failed. That was one that got away. He was battling John Surtees in Belgium when a stone pierced the radiator. Don't worry, the reasons for retirement will get more ridiculous.
Okay.
Canada 68, he led for 72 of the 90 laps when the transmission failed. So that's 3 races in 68. He was actually one of the fastest drivers in 68. Could have fought for the World Championship. That's the period where Arthur Jim Clark is killed, really. You've got Jackie Stewart, Graham Hill and Chris Amon kind of fighting to be the kind of feel. Jackie Stewart obviously did stamp his authority in the end during that sort of post-Clark era. Spanish Grand Prix 1969, he was 40 seconds ahead of Stewart when his engine broke. Belgium 1970 was all over Pedro Rodriguez's BRM, V12 BRM, for the whole race in the March 701, which wasn't much cop as a Grand Prix car, I would suggest, and finished a close second. Monza 71, the famous slipstreaming race that Peter Gethin won. Amon was probably the quickest guy there, but ripped off his whole visor instead of just one and got a blast of 200-mile-an-hour air. You could say that's his fault, but, I mean, even that is pretty ridiculous. And then the race that I was fortunate enough to speak to him about when I went to New Zealand, and he's fantastic. He was fantastic company, and we did a race of my life, and he picked the 1972 French Grand Prix, which he dominated from pole for Matra, got a puncture and charged back, and he took something like a minute out of Jackie Stewart in the lead. He was on a completely different level that day. And he was adamant in the car, and he was just, you know, they should have won that race. It was that race where there were lots of shards and bits of stones. Because I said to him, Stuart says he was deliberately avoiding them, and that, yeah, you weren't. He said, that's nonsense. I didn't, you know, we were quick enough. I could, you know, some of them were just unavoidable, and if they were to be avoided, I could do it. So, yeah, I mean, that's a ridiculous list of races. Any one of those could have been a win. And he did win 2 non-championship F1 races. He won the 71 races at Silverstone 1971 in the March 701 ahead of Jackie Stewart in another car. So, top draw driver, easy number one. Is Damien going to disagree with me?
No, not at all. No. Interesting things about Chris Amon is terrible judgment. Generally, was his main problem, that he understandably ran out of patience with Ferrari because of reliability. But if he'd stuck around for 70. Yeah, you know, and 71, he'd have been a world championship contender, I'm sure. and he knew it. The Matra 72 race, the French Grand Prix you talk about, is always a standout one. I think he was on a circuit that was horrifically dangerous and difficult and fast. He bested Jackie Stewart, which says everything, I think, you know, and he should have won a Grand Prix, definitely, obviously. But he always said he didn't consider himself unlucky because he had this unluckiest man ever tag, which has kind of haunted him throughout the rest of his life. You know, he said he wasn't unlucky. He was incredibly lucky, in fact, because he survived, which I think is true of that era. You know, the chances were, you know, high chance you weren't going to come out of that era, which is, you know, which is why Jackie retired when he did, and so definitely and without looking back, you know, Chris survived, so he had a lot to be thankful for.
Yeah. Well, I think that's in response because it's the Mario Andretti quote, isn't there? He was so unlucky that if he took up undertaking, people would stop dying. I think was the Mario quote. But just also he just did everything else outside. So he won the Tasman Cup in 1969, which was pretty effectively like a winter world championship almost. Against people like Graham Hill and Jochen Rindt, obviously multiple Grand Prix winners, world champions. And actually, he was so. Even in 1970, I think it was, he was still prized by Ferrari in sports cars. There was one race at Monza where there were three 512s against the 917s, and there was left with one Pedro Rodriguez in the Golf 917. And Ferrari moved Eamon around the chasing cars to try and get one of them in range because he was the quickest driver. So he was the Ferrari lead driver at a time when there were some pretty handy Ferrari drivers around. So, yeah, had he... I think Damien's right. I think had he hung around in 70 and 71, if you look at what Jackie Ickx did with that car, okay, maybe Ickx was still getting better, but Eamon surely would have done at least as good a job. And maybe we'd have just added to the list of ridiculous ways that he lost races. It's just the universe didn't fancy it, I don't think.
That's our first list of Series 3. So make sure you tune in same time next week as we continue our series. Our Autosport.com editor Hayden Cobb will join us on the next one, along with these two gentlemen. Quick plug for the book then. When's it out? Is there a date?
I've got to finish it yet.
Okay.
It should be in 2023, hopefully. I'm in the closing yards now, so it's coming soon.
We look forward to having you back when you can tell us all about it. We'll do a whole podcast on it. Sounds like a fantastic
Benetton podcast. That means Damien can write the top 10 Benetton drivers, because it was the one of the few lists I didn't take, because I thought, oh, when's it Benetton, when's it Renault, when's it in Enstone? Obviously Benetton became Renault but raced against Renault and Tolman, and I just thought it sounded too hard.
Well, it's interesting. So most people think Benetton started in 86, because officially that's when the team changed its name from Tolman, but it bought Tolman early in 85. So those who work at the team think that the last Tolman was a Benetton. So Pat Simmons says Benetton started in 85, not 86, and then it finished in 2001, which was the last season. It was called Benetton, even though Renault had bought the team in 2000.
I mean, that's inconsistent right there.
That's inconsistent right there.
You can't say one way, not the other.
You get a little insight into what I haven't done.
Yeah.
I haven't done a Benetton. I just thought it too hard. But maybe I can set... Maybe that's a task for Damien. Once you've done the book, get the book done first.
Let's get that out. All right. Thank you so much for listening. Tune in to number 2 on our top 10s list, Series 3. We'll catch you on the next one.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.